From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, a deep dive into the roots of migration. We're taking you to Honduras, one of the most violent places in the world.
He puts a gun to my head.
We'll talk about gangs, extortion, and the economic situation driving people out of Honduras, and how Mexican authorities are dealing with Central Americans trying to travel to the United States.
Only the next thing we knew, the immigration call from Mexico. So we came and picked them up here because they arrived here today.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So many minors are deported to Honduras these days that there's a special compound that was built just to receive them. It's in San Pedro Sula, made up of a few buildings surrounded by a big red wall. Outside that wall, it's a pretty festive scene. It's Friday afternoon, and a bus full of deportees from Mexico just came in. Their family members wait outside to pick them up. Jose Hernandez is there. He holds a single light blue balloon and wears a pressed shirt, looking like he belongs at a baby shower. Jose is here to pick up his wife and kids. Just 15 days ago, he waved goodbye to them as they took off on a journey north towards the United States. They made it pretty far, through Guatemala, about halfway through Mexico. But eventually, they were stopped by La Migra and sent back. The door of the compound opens, and Jose's kids rush into his arms. Jose gives his two-year-old son the balloon and kisses him on the cheek repeatedly. The kid is crying, but you can't blame him. He's had a big day.
¿Cómo te llamas?
Abigail.
Abigail.
Jose's five-year-old daughter, Abigail, is asked why she wanted to leave Honduras.
No. Yo quería estar con mi papi.
I didn't, she says. I wanted to stay here with my papi.
Me alegro tenerlos, pues, de nuevo.
It makes me very happy, says Jose, to have them back. He's visibly emotional. They leave, and then you don't know if you're ever going to see them again.
La gente sale para allá y no sabe uno si los puede volver a ver.
But for Jose and all the families here, the reunions are bittersweet. Everybody's happy to be back together, but they're disappointed too. After taking such a big bet, risking their lives and their savings, they're disappointed to be back in Honduras, back where they started, instead of starting a new life in the United States. And what they're coming back to, well, it can be complicated. Remember the kids that were showing up at the border this summer? More came from Honduras than any other country. 18,000 of them. But it's not just kids. Over the last few years, immigration from Honduras has increased faster than anywhere else in Central America. More and more Hondurans of all ages are leaving their homes and risking everything for a chance to reach the United States. Today, we're going to spend an hour asking why. What's happening in Honduras right now that's causing so many people to leave? Our producer, Marlon Bishop, recently visited Honduras to help us figure out the answer. Hey, Marlon, we are so glad that you're back and safe.
Hey, Maria, it's good to be back here.
So you had never really spent a tremendous amount of time in Honduras doing deep reporting. You went down, spent several weeks. So what did you find out?
Well, I spent a few weeks traveling around Honduras. I was meeting with journalists, officials, all sorts of people. And my goal was to try to understand what is this sense of crisis that was happening in Honduras right now. And kind of the first thing that you notice really is that when you talk to people, almost everyone you speak to has this really close relationship with homicide, with murder, because almost everyone has someone close to them that's been murdered. And that's because the murder rate in Honduras is so high. It's the highest in the world.
Oh my God, it sounds extraordinary. So how high is it to be the murder capital of the world?
The murder rate is almost one in every 1,000 people. To give you a sense, that's twice as high as the country with the second highest murder rate in the world, which is Venezuela. It is literally on a different scale.
But here's what I don't understand, because it's part of this, you know, region, Central America, but it has a different experience. Honduras does. So historically, how does Honduras end up like this?
Well, I wanted to know that, too. So I called up a guy named Eric Olson, a Central America expert who works at the Woodrow Wilson Institute. And he told me that the story actually starts with bananas.
There's no question that the fruit companies and the U.S. Embassy in Tegucigalpa, the capital, played an outside role in deciding the future of the country.
We're talking like Dole, Chiquita Banana?
Exactly. In fact, the original companies behind those two brands, Standard Fruit and United Fruit, were the dominant players in the Honduran economy for a really long time. They owned a huge percentage of the country's land and often treated Honduras as if it was their personal fiefdom or something. In fact, Honduras is one of the countries that gave us the stereotype of the banana republic. At times, the companies literally ran the country.
One of the lawyers for the fruit companies became president in 1954 at a critical moment.
Olson told me that as a result, the country basically served the fruit industry, and Honduras never had the chance to develop a modern economy. Then, on top of that, there are the oligarchs.
So oligarchs, like elite families that essentially run the country?
Right.
A handful of families not only are major outsized economic powers, but also own newspapers, radio stations, also bankroll political parties.
Honduras is one of the top 10 most unequal countries in the world. All the time while I was there, I heard about these 13 families that basically run everything. Some of them even have their own private militias. The U.S. supported this oligarchy for a really long time because they opposed communism, and that used to be a big thing. Today, they basically run the economy to meet their needs, not the people's.
So when the economy is weak, of course, it's very hard to have really strong and healthy government institutions.
It doesn't have strong police. It doesn't have strong courts or a justice system. Its education system is weak. Its healthcare system. Because its agencies of government are weak, the ability of the country to resist against criminal organizations is quite limited.
So from afar, it really sounds pretty bleak. But did it feel that way to you on the ground with the people of Honduras?
Well, Honduras is definitely in a very tough situation. There's no way around that. But I often found myself feeling really inspired when I was there by these kind of amazing displays of bravery that I would see. For example, these journalists that I was working with, they would receive death threats all the time. And still, they would get up and go out and report the news and try to make Honduras a better place. You know, and I saw this kind of bravery all the time from, you know, an ex-gang member working to help kids find a better path, to a 15-year-old kid leaving his whole world behind to immigrate to the United States so he could support his family. I mean, just imagine doing that.
That's pretty extraordinary. So, Marlon, in order to figure out what the root of the problem was behind all of this, oftentimes it said you got to go to the money. And so that's where we're going to go right now. And weirdly enough, Marlon, you're going to take us there by going to a bus station?
Yes, that's right. A bus station in Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras. In Tegucigalpa, buses are privately owned. So if you want to start a bus company, you just have to buy a bus, find a route that people want to take, and congratulations, you are now a bus company. It's a pretty straightforward business. You pay your driver, pay for gas, collect fares from the passengers. But there's this one cost you wouldn't expect. Every once in a while, when your bus is stopped at an intersection, a kid will come up to the bus, knock on the window, and hand the driver a cell phone.
Viene un niño, te deja un teléfono, y al rato te cae la llamada ahí.
The owner of a bus company explained it to me, but we won't be using his name because of who is on the other end of that phone call. The voice on the phone says, "Hi, I'm calling from such and such a gang, and if you want to keep driving this route, you have to pay us a certain amount of money, or else." This is known as paying your rent.
Renta, así le llamamos nosotros.
These days, the bus owner has 5 different gangs extorting him. And this has become a totally normal thing for him.
Pagarle 500 a la 18.
Every week, he collects money from all his drivers, puts it into envelopes neatly marked with the names of each gang, and he sends a trusted worker to hand him the cash. It's as routine as paying an energy bill. Except the difference is, in this case, all you get in return for your money is not getting killed. This is how gangs in Honduras make most of their money, not from drugs or prostitution or anything like that. The name of the game is extortion. That's the economic machine that keeps the gangs alive. Now, shaking down bus drivers might seem like a small-time hustle, but it adds up to a lot of money. Altogether, there's probably a few million dollars coming out of working people's paychecks every month in Tegucigalpa and going into the pockets of gang members, money that is desperately needed. But the question is, how did Honduras become a place where a bus owner has to pay extortion to five gangs every week? While I was in Honduras, I met a guy who was there from the beginning, an ex-gang member. He had me meet him at this bakery, then led me up four flights of stairs in this empty building, I guess so he could talk where nobody would hear him. About 20 years ago, he joined a gang called MS-13, or as it's known in Honduras, La MS.
Era la MS.
Now, you might have heard of MS-13. The gang is originally from L.A. In the 90s, U.S. officials started aggressively deporting undocumented gang members back to their home countries. As a result, the gang set up shop in Central America.
Pero inicialmente, me paraba en una esquina y
okay, so it's the 90s and gangs are still a relatively new thing in Honduras. The ex-gang member I spoke to and his friends are like, we need to figure out how to make some money. So they stand on a street corner looking scary and say, hey, give me some money to the people in the neighborhood. He says he could stand on the corner between 5 and 7 in the evening and make 10 bucks, enough to buy some weed and a snack for after.
De 5 a 7, yo me ganaba 10 dólares y tenía mi consumo de droga.
He says the rationale behind extorting his neighbors was this. The streets, they're mine.
Las calles son mías.
So anyone who is using them, a guy walking down the street, a vendor, whoever, they're using something that's mine. So they have to rent them from me.
Yo se las alquilo.
In the next few years, MS-13 starts getting into more serious crimes. They're leaving the neighborhood and committing robberies, stealing cars, even kidnapping people and holding them for ransom. But soon, the government starts to push back, starts throwing gang members in jail as fast as they can. So you have this gang that's used to bringing in lots of money by roaming around committing these crimes. Now the government is making that harder.
Okay, nosotros no nos vamos a arriesgar.
But then somebody in the gang has this brilliant insight. You don't have to go around robbing and stealing. You can stay put in your neighborhood and the money will come to you. It will literally come rolling down your block on wheels. You can start extorting the bus companies.
¿A quién le cobramos la renta?
The crazy thing is, if you talk to gang members about it, they talk like guys running a bank or something.
Es un mecanismo fácil.
He says it was an easy mechanism for reducing risk and increasing profits.
Mejor ingreso.
And it worked. MS-13 was making good money this way and keeping its members out of jail. But if you're running a successful business for long enough, somebody is going to come along and break up your monopoly. And in the next few years, lots of other gangs get into the same business. You even start getting these freelance extorters, people who aren't affiliated with any gang at all. They just go through the phone book, threatening random people in the hopes they'll scare somebody into giving them money.
Y eso complica completamente.
And just like that, no more monopoly. And that made things more complicated.
Porque ya no hay un monopolio.
Coming up, what happens to extortion when more gangs come into the picture? Stay with us. No se vayan.
Ya que escribiste desde el norte y te hacen falta muchas cosas, ahí te mando un encarguito cortesía de Doña Rosa. Ojalá pasen la aduana y las compartas con mis tíos y que al probarlas se olviden por un ratito del frío. Te van los nacatamales, te va un chicharrón con yuca, una olla de curiles, tajaditas y montucas. Te mando un buen chinamito, un atolice y baleadas. Te va un tapado lanchano y sopa de capirotadas. Y ojalá pase la aduana y que no anden
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all, on the web at rwjf.org.
Welcome back to this special edition of Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. On today's show, we're taking a deep look at root causes of migration in Honduras. One of those causes is the extortion business that powers the local gangs. MS-13 was the first gang to start extorting bus and taxi drivers, calling them up and threatening to kill them if they don't pay. When we left off, more and more gangs were getting into the extortion business. Here's our producer again, Marlon Bishop.
By the mid-2000s, lots of gangs were trying to break into the extortion business. But before a gang can get away with charging extortion, it has to prove that it is a legitimately scary gang. It has to make good on its threats sometimes. You could say it has to advertise. I visited a guy who experienced this firsthand. Like the other people in this story, he asked us not to use his name to protect his safety.
Eso es tu casa. Sí.
I visited this person at a cinder block house up in the hills of Tegucigalpa. We sat at his kitchen table, and he told me his story. For 28 years, he drove a taxi. But not a taxi in the sense we mean here in New York City. In Tegucigalpa, taxis drive regular routes and pick up passengers along the way. You can think of it like a tiny bus. One day last year, the taxi driver says he was driving his route when the gangs came for him. You'll hear a translation here.
Primero me llegaron a dejar un teléfono. Yo no lo quise agarrar.
First, they tried to leave a cell phone with me. I didn't want to take it, but this girl gave it to me.
Me lo puso y me... Nah, me. Hablamos de parte de la mafia, me.
I put it to my ear, and they said, we're calling from La Mafia.
La Mafia, translation, the Mafia, is a relatively new gang in Tegucigalpa.
And I said, no, I don't have anything to talk to you about. And boom, I threw the phone back at the girl.
His thinking was, I already pay extortion to all of these gangs. If I don't give these new guys a chance to talk to me, they can't extort me. Then a week goes by.
It's like 1 p.m. I was parking my car, and when I looked in the mirror to look behind me to see if there was another car coming, I saw this tough-looking guy coming towards me. He puts a gun to my head.
The gun backfired twice.
Cuando yo siento, me tiro del carro. I threw myself out of the car and I ran after the guy. He slipped into the market and I didn't want to follow him after that.
The next day, he couldn't bring himself to get back into his cab. For a long time after the botched shooting, he didn't even leave his house. And even now, more than a year later, he's still clearly on edge.
There's no law anymore. There's no respect for anybody. It's going to get to the point where it's like the Wild West. If you want somebody to respect your rights, you have to walk around with a gun in your hand.
Just a week after the taxi driver's near miss, one of his coworkers on the same route was gunned down. And this happens all the time. This year alone, more than 40 bus drivers in Tegucigalpa were murdered. And that's just the bus drivers. Since 2012, more than 200 taxi drivers have been killed. And it's not just murders. When Los Chirizos, one of the newer gangs, got started, they decided they needed to stand out. So they started hijacking buses and setting them on fire, once or twice with the driver inside the bus. You might think that killing the people that pay you every week isn't such a good business move, but it actually ends up working in the gang's favor sometimes. That's because the scarier you are, the more you can get away with charging in extortion money. Ever since the bus burnings, Los Chirizos get higher extortion fees than almost any other gang. This is probably a good place to mention that it's not just the bus and taxi drivers being extorted these days. It's the women in the market selling clothes, the auto shops, everybody you can think of. There are reports of even lawyers and politicians being extorted. And I heard of at least one plastic surgeon who had to pay up. It's no surprise that this is a major drag on the economy. The Tegucigalpa Chamber of Commerce estimates that 18,000 businesses have closed in Honduras because of extortion. I spoke to another taxi driver, a younger guy in his 20s, who also says he stopped working because of extortion.
Yo por eso me retiré de los taxis, por eso, porque yo tengo hijos.
I have kids, and I don't want to die and leave them alone, he says, matter-of-factly. It's just too dangerous.
El trabajo es demasiado peligroso.
Sí, es más peligroso.
And there is a whole nation of people like this taxi driver, people who aren't contributing to the economy because of extortion. Think about it. It doesn't make a lot of sense to invest or open a business if the end result is that you're just going to be extorted and possibly killed. The government, of course, knows extortion is a major problem. They recently launched this special anti-extortion task force to try to deal with it. They actually made some arrests while I was in town. They were having a press conference, and I decided to go. A government PR lady stood up in front of the reporters and read a long press release.
Fuerza Nacional de Extorsión sigue dando respuesta a la ciudadanía y este día dos equipos se han trasladado en dos puntos diferentes de la ciudad.
Police wearing ski masks hauled out a few people in handcuffs, and they did not look like gang kingpins. There was a 15-year-old boy, a 19-year-old woman. They looked more like scared kids. These were basically low-level employees who picked up envelopes of cash for the gangs. The former taxi driver I spoke with who almost got shot, he says these kinds of press conferences are on TV all the time these days.
Que la policía que dice que agarra este, que agarra el otro, que agarra el otro, no.
He says the police always say that they got this guy or they got that guy, but it's just a facade to give hope to the people that something is going to change. But that's impossible, he adds.
Que imposible.
Que va a ser bien difícil que lo resuelva las autoridades.
This is the ex-gang member we heard from earlier, and he doesn't buy it either. He says that the police are missing the point entirely, which is the total lack of opportunities for young people from rough neighborhoods. Since he left MS-13, he works to try and prevent young people from falling into the gang life. But he says it's hard, because in many cases, the gang is the only employer in town. He says you see it all the time. A whole family will be able to put food on the table because of the kid who got involved with the gang. The family might lie to themselves, pretend they don't know where the money came from because they don't want to see their child as a criminal. But at the same time, they rely on him and the money the gang brings in. On my last day in Tegucigalpa, I went to the opening of a new bus station. It was part of a government push to make the buses safer. It has walls and an exit guarded by a man with a very large weapon. A few hundred members of the transport industry were there. There were speeches and a polite audience. The bus owner we heard from before, he was there. He said the new safe bus station is a nice idea. But he guarantees that by Monday, the gang members will be inside the gates.
Pero te acredito que el día lunes, después de este feriado, ya están los mareros aquí.
And on Wednesday, like he does every Wednesday, he'll slip some bills into neatly marked envelopes and pay his rent.
Yo la conocí en un taxi. Camino al club, yo la conocí en un taxi. En camino al club.
That's Latino USA producer Marlon Bishop. Marlon's story on extortion in Honduras was produced in association with Round Earth Media. Germán Andino contributed to reporting. The extortion and gang violence we've been talking about has compelled many Hondurans to flee the country towards the U.S. That means going through Guatemala and then Mexico.
Hondurans are among the most visible and the most vulnerable migrants on the migrant trail.
That's Noelle Brigden from Marquette University. She studies Central American migration, and she says that Honduras has a different migration history than other countries in the region. Guatemalans and Salvadorans began coming to the U.S. in the 80s as refugees from their respective civil wars. But Honduras didn't have a war. Honduran migration
begins en masse in 1998 following Hurricane Mitch, as you have people being pushed in the wake of an environmental disaster.
Está todo destruido, sinceramente.
The water took everything, this woman says.
Now we are staying in the streets.
Since their migration history is so recent, it means that Hondurans are the least experienced in making the dangerous way north through Mexico. Noel says that changes how they travel.
Hondurans are much more likely to use the Catholic shelters along the way than Salvadorans and Guatemalans. It's a sign of their desperation as they travel.
Migrant shelters are often found along the path of La Bestia, the freight train used by many Central Americans trying to reach the U.S. The shelters provide a safe place to rest, to eat and shower. Migrants tend to stay a day or two at each shelter, but the most vulnerable, such as women and children or injured, stay longer. For them, these modest shelters have become a temporary home. Maria Inés Zamudio takes us inside one shelter in Tenosique, a city just north of the Guatemalan border.
They run to catch a freight train that will take them closer to their dream. Central American migrants jump on top of La Bestia. Once they find a spot to sit, they cheer and they say goodbye to the friends they've made here in Tenosique. It's a scene that's repeated across Mexico. As the sun sets and the sound of the train fades into the distance, the migrant shelter quiets down. That's priest Tomás González, who runs the shelter, which is funded by the Catholic Church. The situation in Central America is truly dramatic, he says. Human beings are suffering a great tragedy, and the traffic through Mexico has turned into hell, he says. Our commitment is to be here and help them, even if it's only to make their trip a little easier. The shelter is named La 72, or the 72, after the 72 Central American migrants who were killed and buried in a mass grave in northern Mexico in 2010. That painful history is reflected in a large mural hanging on the wall. It shows a map of the country highlighting the path of La Bestia and the shelters along the way. It also warns migrants about the dangers, showing which states are controlled by which drug cartels. For the cartels, migrants have become merchandise they can trade or sell to get whatever amount of money they want, Father Tomás says. There's a small infirmary in a courtyard here, with tables and a basketball court. The men sleep inside a church while their dorm is under construction. The women live in a modest room filled with gym mats where they sleep. Most stay indoors out of the unforgiving sun. Men are not allowed here. This is the only space where the women feel safe from the dangers of this journey. Jacinta, a mother of two, says she escaped her abusive husband in Honduras. Here in Tenosique, she's looking for work to finance the rest of her trip. She says she was fired from a job cooking and cleaning at a restaurant because she's black. The owner called me on the phone and said, Morena, I do want to have you here working with us, but the other employees don't, she says. I felt my heart tightening and I said, wow. But I said, okay, don't worry, and I walked away. But despite the setbacks these women face every day, somehow they manage to support each other and even help each other smile. Reina is a single mother traveling with her 12-year-old son. She sits on the concrete floor talking to the other women. She tells them that she wants to practice her English, but the only word she knows is yes. She uses this to describe the things she wants to buy in the U.S.
Muchas cosas. Yes, una casa de dos plantas. Yes, un carro.
I want a lot of things, yes, she says. I want a two-story house, yes. I want a car, yes. I want a handsome husband, yes. I'll find him and make him marry me. The rest of the women left uncontrollably, and Reina mumbles, I think being here is driving me crazy. But Jacinta says it's crucial to keep a good sense of humor. Otherwise, the sadness takes over. It's not easy. I can joke around with the other women, but I also cry every day. It's not easy being here, she says. For Latino USA, I am Marina Zamudio in Tenosique, Mexico.
La, 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 la For an extended version of Maria's piece on migrant shelters, visit us on the web at latinousa.org. For migrants like the women we just heard from, traveling through Mexico has become extremely dangerous. Here's Noelle Brigden from Marquette University once again.
Since 2005, there's been an explosion of organized and systemic criminal violence against migrants crossing Mexico.
Migrant rights groups in Mexico estimate that since 2006, anywhere between 70 and 100,000 Central Americans have disappeared in Mexico. Despite the risks of the journey, the number of Central Americans traveling through the country, especially Hondurans, has been climbing for the last 4 years. In 2013, the Mexican Immigration Institute counted more than 80,000 Central American migrants, and those are just the ones who got caught. Those who are caught in transit are almost always deported home. Now, in the U.S., if you're not at or near the border, an immigration hearing is required before you can be deported. But in Mexico, you're automatically deported if you're caught anywhere in the country. No trial, no nothing.
It's been a sort of unprecedented increase in the enforcement of immigration laws so that you've had raids. There's also talk of improving the train infrastructure such that it becomes more difficult for migrants to get on the train. That includes erecting barriers and making sure that the train moves more quickly.
Last year, Mexico deported 32,000 Hondurans, almost as many as were deported by the U.S. last year. This summer, under pressure from the United States, Mexico made a plan that could mean even more deportations.
En México, estamos convencidos de que el fenómeno migratorio debe ser atendido desde una perspectiva regional, corresponsable y sobre todo humana, pero también...
In July, President Enrique Peña Nieto launched Plan Frontera Sur, a southern border security strategy. The plan will reportedly receive American funding through the Mérida Initiative, an anti-drug military aid package. It calls for tougher immigration controls, both at the border with Guatemala and beyond. A major part of the plan is about limiting access to La Bestia, the train traveling north. But Noel Brigden says the plan is flawed.
Despite the fact that this Plan Sur is being justified by the Mexican government as a sort of humanitarian intervention, there is a complete consensus among human rights activists that this is detrimental to the security of the migrants themselves.
Because of the changes of Plan Frontera Sur, a fraction of the migrants that used to ride La Bestia are able to ride it now. And that's changed the routes migrants are taking north. Coming up, we find out how the new border plan is affecting migrants and what happens to the kids that are sent back.
Apparently they didn't make it, so it was pretty much like a road trip for them, but I'm glad they stay okay, in good health and everything.
Stay with us. No se vayan.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the Dreamwave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And American Jewish World Service, working in developing countries to end poverty and advance human rights. Information available at ajws.org.
Welcome back to this special edition of Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we're talking about violence and migration in Honduras. Now, just a little earlier, we were discussing how the Mexican government has been trying to make it harder for Central American migrants to travel north through their country. But as Jasmine Guards reports, that can mean it's even more dangerous now for migrants who do make it into Mexico. Just a quick note, for the safety of some of the people in this story who are fleeing domestic violence, we've withheld their names.
This is not the first time this Honduran woman has tried to run away.
Mi esposo me maltrataba, usaba de mí.
My husband beat me.
O sea, y lo hacía más que todo enfrente de mis niños.
I couldn't stand that he did it in front of our kids.
She left home in Honduras once, but went back because she was worried about her kids. When the woman got there, her husband, a gang member, shot her in the foot. She waited until she could walk again. Then one day, she pretended she was taking the kids on an errand. The woman, who's 27, is part of this year's Honduran exodus. Most media coverage has focused on the estimated 60,000 Central American minors who were detained at the U.S.-Mexico border. In reality, human rights workers and activists report that minors are leaving Central America with adults, often with their mothers. The problem is, the routes they're being forced to take are so dangerous, migrant women can barely protect their children. Mark Bosk describes it this way.
Este proceso de invisibilización empieza precisamente cada vez antes.
Invisibilización, becoming invisible. Bosk is the head coordinator for Doctors Without Borders in Mexico. He says on the surface, it looks like the number of people crossing from Central America has gone down. That may be happening largely because of Mexico's Plan Frontera Sur, the Southern Border Plan. The plan has kept thousands of people off La Bestia, the freight train migrants ride as stowaways to get to northern Mexico. But for those migrants who do make it through, Bosk says reports of violence and exploitation have increased.
El hecho de que no puedan utilizar el tren y tengan que empezar a manejarse por rutas alternativas.
The fact that they cannot use the train and they have to start taking alternate routes exposes them to organized crime and human trafficking networks more than before. Back when people knew a route and where they had to go.
Que lo que venía siendo hasta ahora, donde ya más o menos todos conocían el camino y por dónde tenían que ir.
That means migrants are no longer traveling on routes where they'd have access to shelters or medical attention, he adds. They'll sleep in clandestine housing run by cartels or human smugglers, where they're vulnerable to all types of abuses, something like what happened to the Honduran and her children. In the playground of a shelter, the kids say their journey to Mexico was cold, long, and the train they rode was scary because that's where they kill people.
My kids endured hunger. They endured the cold. By the time we got to Coatzacoalcos, they were very sick.
Coatzacoalcos is an industrial city run by the notorious Zeta cartel, a place where migrants trying to get north often get trapped. The woman says when a Mexican man approached her and told her he ran a shelter, she went with him. The man kept her and her children there for 3 days, and every night he raped her while the kids lay in the same bed. The man also fondled her daughter. The woman thinks he was a sex trafficker.
I don't even know how I escaped. The woman who cleaned his house kind of left the door open. I left all our things in there.
With no money and no belongings, the Honduran woman and her kids rode the freight train all the way to Mexico City, where they found a real migrant shelter. When she got there, the first thing she asked for was an HIV test. The woman says her daughter still has nightmares about what happened on their trip. Her son has violent outbursts. Technically, the Mexican government does have refugee visas for migrants fleeing danger, but they're nearly impossible to come by. From January to September of this year, the Mexican government had 1,525 applications for refugee status, but it only accepted 247. The woman knows her chances of getting one of those visas are slim, and her kids are homesick, so she's decided to go back to Honduras. Besides, she says, she's exhausted.
Pues últimamente ya me siento cansada, ya no quiero más, ya no. No, ya no, eh.
For Latino USA, I'm Jasmine Garst.
Migration officials in Honduras that Latino USA spoke to told us that so far, the unaccompanied minors from Honduras who showed up at the U.S. border this summer have not yet been deported. But plenty of young migrants have been deported back to Honduras from Mexico. As our producer Marlon Bishop reports, it's not always so easy for them to pick their lives back up where they left them. Marlon has our story now from San Pedro Sula in Honduras, outside the center where young deportees are received.
And what are you doing here today?
I'm here, I just came to pick up my two cousins who had left to the United States, and apparently they didn't make it, so it was pretty much like a road trip for them, but I'm glad they okay, in good health and everything.
Franklin Alvarado was not happy when he got word that his little cousins tried to migrate. He was once an immigrant himself. He lived most of his life in the States before being deported. That's why he speaks English so well. But his cousins left without even telling their mom. And that's not cool.
They just left the house, man. Only the next thing we knew, the immigration call from Mexico. So we came and picked them up here because they arrived here today.
The cousins in question step out of the deportation center and walk into a flurry of hugs from family members. Johan is 15. His brother Carlos is 17. We're not using their last names for their protection. The brothers decided to try and leave Honduras after a run-in with some gang members from their town. Here's Johan. The gang members told the brothers that they had to join the gang. If not, they would kill them, their families as well. Johan and Carlos told their dad, an immigrant who lives in San Francisco, about what happened. Dad got worried and decided to pay a smuggler to bring them across the border, stat. Now, Carlos, the older brother, says he's nervous about being back. He doesn't know what the gang will say or do to him. How will you avoid them, I ask. Never leave the house, he says. A few hours ago, the brothers rolled through the border between Guatemala and Honduras on a Mexican coach bus full of young deportees. Yaeli Mia is a volunteer with the Honduran Red Cross. They run a little station here at the border. She says for the last few days in a row, there's been 6 buses from Mexico every day. Earlier in the year, the flow of returning migrants was even crazier, she says. 15 buses might come in one day, with only a single Honduran bus coming to meet them, and half the kids would get stranded at the border. Situations like these have called the government's readiness into question.
Absolutely. They are not prepared for these children coming back.
This is Yolanda Gonzalez. She works at a Catholic NGO that deals with migration in Honduras, kind of a watchdog. She says there have been all kinds of problems. For example, for a long time, the Center for Returned Kids didn't even have a bathroom. And at the height of the crisis, a large number of the minors would somehow get lost during the deportation process from Mexico.
20%, they were missing. They didn't arrive at San Pedro Sula.
I spoke with Marta Reyes, an official with the agency that handles childhood development. She couldn't confirm or comment about the lost deportees, but she says, regardless, the system for receiving kids has been steadily improving. For now, she says, they're able to attend the needs of the kids who are arriving. It's easy for the government to say that everything is under control, but I wanted to see for myself how the deported kids are adjusting to being back. So the next day, I visit Johan and Carlos at their home in a small city called La Lima. The house is sparsely furnished. On one wall, a sign reads, "Welcome home," with an exclamation point. The boy's mother works part-time cleaning a school, but it's not enough money to sustain the six kids she supports, so she supplements her income selling loose cigarettes and nips of liquor. The family scrapes by on a few dollars a day. There wasn't enough money for Carlos to attend school this year, so he helps his mom clean it instead. She makes him do the bathrooms. "It's really gross," he says. "I wouldn't recommend it to anybody."
Sí, eso sí, que es feo. No lo recomiendo a nadie.
When Carlos talks about his trip to Mexico and back, he has this kind of amazing teenage optimism about it. He says it was kind of fun.
Fue divertido porque conocí lugares que no había.
He says it was fun because I got to see new places I'd never seen, try new food I never tried. When I ask him what's next for him, he tells me that he and his brother are planning to try and cross the border again, and soon. The longer they wait here, the more likely they are to run into trouble with the gang. I ask him if he's scared to go to Mexico again.
Nah,
he says. "I'm scared to be back here in Honduras, but crossing the border, it's not a big deal."
No es gran cosa.
I met a lot of young deportees while I was in Honduras, and almost every single one told me the same thing, that they will attempt to migrate again. And that's why, in a way, the stepped-up enforcement and the deportations, it might all be in vain. As long as kids like Carlos and Johan are sent right back into the dangerous situations that compelled them to leave in the first place, their deportations will just be temporary. Yolanda Gonzalez says this is the biggest problem with Honduras's way of dealing with deported minors. There's no policy for reintegration. No follow-up.
The process ends when the kids come to Honduras, and when the parents come, perhaps they are given $25 to $50, and it ends there. This child disappears again for the state.
If all goes to plan, Carlos imagines that soon enough he'll be in San Francisco with his father, but he's nervous about the idea of reuniting.
Casi no lo he visto. Solo por fotos.
"I've almost never seen him, just in photos," he says. His father left 11 years ago, when Carlos was really young. He sent money here and there, but they've barely had a relationship beyond that. "What do you think the U.S. will be like?" I ask.
En mi mente, muy frío.
Carlos perks up. "In my mind," he says, "it's really cold, but nice. I want to see the bridge. What's it called?"
El Golden Gate.
We're interrupted by a plane landing overhead. Carlos is used to the sound. He lives right near the airport that serves San Pedro Sula, one of the biggest cities in the country. He's never been on a plane, but he says he had a friend who was deported from Mexico on one and told him all about it.
Dice que a la hora de subirse,
"I hear when you're going up, it's not a good feeling," he says. "But once you get up in the air, it's really beautiful." But it's kind of annoying, he adds, that it takes days and days to get over there by land, and the plane can send you back in just a few hours. I became Facebook friends with Carlos and Johan before I left, so that we could stay in touch. About a month later, I saw something come across my newsfeed that kind of made me drop my jaw. A photo of Johan standing on a hill, with the Golden Gate Bridge stretched out behind him.
Latino USA producer Marlon Bishop. And by the way, if you want to see photos from our reporting trip to Honduras, we have some beautiful albums up on our website, latinousa.org, as well as on our Facebook page. So to end our show, as many of you know, we always do a segment called Sabiduría, which means words of wisdom. And for today's show, we're going to bring back our producer, Marlon Bishop, to tell us a little bit more about what he took away from his recent reporting trip to Honduras. First of all, what was it like for you to meet young migrants like the brothers that we just heard about?
Well, for one thing, they were such teenagers and, they were so concerned with normal teenage things, how good their pictures looked on Facebook, the crushes at school, except they had this other burden that teenagers in the U.S. don't have, which is that they need to flee their country because their lives are in danger. And that was kind of hard to take in a way. I think kind of the main thing I took away from talking to all the migrants that I met in Honduras is that immigration isn't something shameful or secret or anything like that in Honduras. It's just a normal part of every single family's life. And given what people are facing, taking the decision to leave is really the most natural thing in the world.
All right. So with those numbers of people leaving, how do you figure, Marlon, that things can actually get better in Honduras?
I think things can get better in Honduras, but I think it's going to take a lot of work. People have lost faith in their government in a big way and lost faith that they can deliver things like ending the extortion business and reducing gangs. But I'm given hope by the people that I met there who are really working on a grassroots level to try to improve the situation. I think there's a lot of people who desperately want Honduras to be better. People don't want to leave their country. People don't want to leave Honduras and leave their families and the food they like and the beautiful country they live in and take this really dangerous trip to the United States. And if they didn't have to, they wouldn't, you know?
It's a matter, I mean, for many of them, literally a decision about life and death. But thanks so much for all of your reporting, Marlon, and for really connecting with Honduras. It helps us as listeners connect to the country too. Thanks so much, Marlon.
Thanks, Maria.
Before we go, we want to acknowledge the recent announcement that U.S. policy towards Cuba is changing dramatically, and that diplomatic relations are opening up. We've been covering this story attentively on Twitter and Facebook, and we want to hear from you for our future coverage. Did your family come from Cuba? Are you planning on visiting now? What are the stories you want to hear? Are you going to start investing? Tweet us at LatinoUSA, visit us on Facebook, and help us write this first draft of history as it happens con Cuba. The on-the-ground reporting in Honduras heard in this special episode of Latino USA was produced in association with Round Earth Media. Thanks to all the people at Round Earth that made Marlon's reporting trip to Honduras possible, including Beverly Abel, Conrad Fox, and Mary Stuckey. And special thanks to the Honduran journalists that co-reported many of today's stories with Marlon, Yolani Perez of the wonderful Radio Progreso, and Germán Andino. Maria Zamudio's reporting was made possible by a fellowship with the International Center for Journalists, sponsored by the Ford Foundation. And, mis queridos, that's it for this week. Our special edition of Latino USA was produced by Marlon Bishop, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Laura Calzada is our intern. And Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on my Instagram. Have a great week, everybody. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security at carnegie.org. And by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all.
Honduras, imagine that soon enough, Honduras will be in Honduras with his father, Honduras.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. This is NPR.